Today, dog training that goes way beyond sit and stay. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Dr. Ian Dunbar. He's a veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and world-renowned dog trainer. He's the author of many best-selling books and videos about dog training and the founder of Serious Dog Training. He believes that dog training should be fun for dogs as well as people. He believes we need to keep our dogs' interests in mind when we're training, and yes, that includes butt sniffing and squirrel chasing. And he gave the world insight into the canine mind as a consultant for the movie Up. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Dr. Ian Dunbar. He's a veterinarian, an animal behaviorist, and dog trainer. He's the author of many best-selling books and videos about dog training and the founder of Serious Dog Training. He's the inventor of puppy classes, was apparently the first man to stick treats inside a Kong, and as the consultant for the movie Up, he taught us all a little bit about what dogs are really thinking, and he is here with me today. Dr. Dunbar, thank you so much for being here.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to go back to your childhood. Did you grow up with dogs?
I did. I was very lucky. I grew up on a farm, and we couldn't see another house from our little cottage, and so I spent most of the day roaming the fields and three dogs following me, a Springer Spaniel, my grandpa's Lab, and my uncle's Jack Russell.
And as you grew, you decided you wanted to become a veterinarian. What made you want to go further? What did you see that made you think that you needed to get involved in animal behavior?
Well, it was quite sort of fortuitous. It was actually decided for me when I was about five that I should be a veterinarian. And I never thought about it. That's what I was doing. And then when I got to vet college, I thought, you know, that's going to have me stuck in one place, and I'm really peripatetic. I love traveling. And so I thought, well, I want to go to California, and then what shall I do? Academics, obviously. And I liked obstetrics. I liked behavior. I like cows and dogs. So I tossed a coin, came down dogs, and I thought, I'll study sexual behavior of dogs in California. And I started doing that. A lady from the Extension, the University Extension, went to a veterinarian and said, do you know anyone who can teach a 10-week course on dog behavior? And he says, actually, I do. There's an English vet over here studying for a PhD in dog behavior. And I taught this course, and I loved it, much more so than teaching at the university. You know, at the university, the question hands go up, and they say, is this on the midterm? But when I was talking to pet owners, they were so fascinated. And that really just turned me on. And then that became my career.
Your understanding of dog behavior, I mean, obviously you studied it as you got your PhD. But did you draw upon research or did you draw upon life experience when sharing your understanding of dog behavior?
Well, I was very lucky growing up. My grandfather and my dad both used old-time training method. So off-leash, they use food, they use toys. So it's the way I grew up training. And they were techniques that were nearly just destroyed in the beginning of the 20th century. Research was really good because it enabled me to just sit and watch dogs. I mean, that's what I did. 3 hours a day in the California sunshine, sitting and watching dogs interact. But then I read a book that had a tremendous effect called Serious by Olaf Stapledon. It was published, I think, in the 1890s, a science fiction book. He's a philosopher. And it's about a dog that had the brain power of a human, but the body and senses of a dog. And so he could communicate if you strapped a little pencil to his paw so he could type to his owner. And from reading that book, it made me try and look at things from the dog's point of view. Because like I was talking about yesterday in the seminar, you know, people always talk about a behavior problem. And I say, if you interview the dog and say, well, tell me about this barking problem. He says, you know, problem? What problem? That's what we do. In fact, that's my favorite activity. And when you look at it that way, and so now you put barking or jumping up or running away on cue, they become really good rewards in training for teaching the dog to do the opposite. So I teach a dog to jump up and hug, which is the reward occasionally if he comes and sits. And if he walks nicely by my side with little Hugo, my French bulldog, I say, pull. And he loves it. And so I walk round, you know, dog pulling me on leash. Who's that? Oh, that's the dog trainer. But then I call him to my side, Hugo Heel, and he's immaculate because I'm fair to him. You know, he'll walk by my side for a bit, then I'll let him pull.
So you, in your TED talk that you gave a few years ago, you talk about how we need to think about dogs' interests. And you just mentioned a few. But so what does an owner do to need to get into the mindset of their dog?
Well, I think they've got to start off and say, right, we're getting a dog. What do they do? Let me list the things. It'll be a great surprise to, you know, prospective puppy owners. They pee, they poop, they chew, they dig, they bark. Okay. They are hyperactive. They have a joy for life. We just did a workshop in Minneapolis, and this dog broke free. He's a black lab. I have never seen a dog so happy in his life. It's like, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. And he ran around the room. I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. And I said to everyone, look at this. And that's what you have to marshal, this sort of joie de vivre, this excitement. You want to marshal that under control. And there's your hunting dog. There's your obedient dog. There's your games dog. You don't squash it. And most people, you know, whatever a dog does, woof, shut up, pull on leash, jerk. A little bit of hyperactivity, you know, settle down. And so I like to give the dog and children opportunities to be themselves. And so my favorite activity with dogs and children is we put craziness on cue. I call it silly time. And I used to say to my son or my dog, okay, be silly. And they can be as silly as they like. And then I say, okay, Jamie, turn into normal Jamie.
And Jamie's your son,
he's
not
my
your
son.
Dog, right?
Yeah. And but the same with Omaha and Phoenix. And before you're going into, say, a show ring, I used to think getting up in the morning, because my first Malamute, I mean, it really was crazy and it was embarrassing in the ring because everyone's looking at me. And he was going to go, woo, woo, and then bounce around. And I thought, well, right, I'm going to camp with him. So I'd car camp before the show. I'd get up at 6 in the morning, which isn't me. I would jog with him about 8 miles. I get to the show ring, I'm exhausted, and I've just been training him for endurance, and now, woo, he can jump around with renewed vigor. Then I realize, no, it's the mental exercise they need. And so just engage him mentally, have him do things, but above all, let him go crazy. So I used to stand in front of the ring, and the steward says, you ready, Dr. Dunbar? I said, no, wait a moment. I said, Omaha, be silly. And he goes, woo, 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 like this. And I say, now, Omaha, sit and heal. And he'd be fine. And I would get about 10 minutes of concentration from him just because I let him let it out of his system.
So what did you see in dog training? And, you know, a lot of us are old enough to remember the very authoritarian type of dog training, dog obedience classes, but some of us aren't old enough to remember that. So what did you see that made you think, I need to do something to change the kinds of things that people are teaching their dogs?
Well, I didn't. This is the weirdest thing. I had never seen on-leash training. You know, growing up on the farm, we didn't have leashes. The dogs just followed us. And it wasn't until after I'd started puppy classes that I actually went to see an on-leash class. And I started the puppy classes because my wife did an intervention. I was a house husband and loved it at home. You know, I was rewiring the house and remodeling the house and doing the cooking and the housework, you know. And she was out working and had a very good job. And then one day she got some people and said, Ian, I want you to go and sit on that rock and think. And then come back and tell me how you're going to bring money into this relationship. I thought, oh, my word, no, no, I've got to work. So I went outside with a list and thought, well, it should be to do with dogs because I'd been researching them for 10 years. And it's got to be fun. It's got to be worthwhile. It's got to be reproducible. And I thought, I'm going to teach puppy classes. And it just came to me because it's the obvious thing to do. And then when I got back to Berkeley, this was in Bodega Bay, and we were having a long weekend, I thought, well, I'm going to have a look at how they actually train dogs in class. And I went and looked. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I thought, what are you people doing? And then I analyzed it as a scientist. And I sort of wrote down, because, you know, I'd been trained to observe interactive behavior. So I wrote down the behavior of the person and the dog. Like if the person said sit, I put S, heel, H, and then little tick if they praised it, an X if they gave it a leash jerk. I went home and analyzed the material, and I thought, oh, my word, every time they say sit, there's a 90% likelihood they're going to jerk the dog. Every time they say heel, it's followed by 2.7 leash jerks. So they're turning the command actually into a negative punisher. So the command predicts punishment, so the dog's demotivated. But the bizarre thing was, I went back 2 weeks later and rescored. It's exactly the same. The dogs hadn't learnt a thing. And so you can't call the leash correction or punishment, because by definition, a punishment is a stimulus that causes the immediately preceding behavior to decrease in frequency and be less likely to occur in the future. Well, it was still occurring in the future at the same rate, so the punishment wasn't working. Therefore, the leash jerk's not a punishment. What is it? Harassment? Abuse? So I sort of analyzed it like this and thought, well, we'll solve that problem by just having the puppies off leash. Can't jerk it then. Funny thing was, though, back then, you know, people were so used to training dogs on leash and jerking them. When I'd have them, like old-time trainers, let the puppy off leash, their left hand was still jerking like this, you know. It was really funny.
How does a dog's behavior change on a leash as opposed to off a leash?
It generally gets, well, depends on the trainer. That first you get this deception. So we see a lot of this on TV. Someone takes a dog and jerk, 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 and the dog looks like he's trained. But he's only trained because he's on leash and can't get away. If you want to see his real behavior, cut the leash and you realize this TV trainer has not trained the dog. He's just made the dog scared of doing anything when he's within grabbing reach or on leash. We get the opposite effect, though, with off-leash trained dogs. With off-leash trained dogs, they learn to mind, they stick close to you off-leash, and the owners have developed these off-leash skills. But when they put the leash on, they turn their brain off, and then the dog starts pulling. It's really interesting. So when I get to the point where I let people put the leash on so we can teach leash work, I say, you can't hold it. You just drape it around your neck. I want your brain alert. And then we let them hold the end of the leash. I say, you know what? You're going to hold a glass of water in your left hand like this. That stops them jerking or stops them pulling the leash. And say, we walk around the room and one leash jerk and it gives them a cold splash in the face. But it's so it's very interesting. Dogs are totally different on leash and off. The biggest change, I would say, dogs are much more dog-dog reactive on leash, because the other end of the leash, you got the owner who's fueling it. And this is, it's one of the sole advantage, I would say, men have in dog training. That, you know, on leash with the wife who's done all the work and taking the dog to class, the dog's reactive. She gives the dog to her husband. He doesn't give a damn. He lets it off leash and it's fine. It doesn't fight at all, you know.
But does the dog feel trapped when it's off a leash or on a leash? Is that why they're so much more reactive?
No, I think it's because they can't do their own thing. And the person at the other end of the leash really fuels the problem. And so the dog says, look, my owner's really scared and unreliable. Go away, go away. Whoa, she's right. Unreliable.
We're going to take a short break. I'll be back. I'm talking with Dr. Ian Dunbar. He's a veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and dog trainer. You can find out more about his work at dogstardaily.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about dog training with Dr. Ian Dunbar. He's a veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and dog trainer, the author of many best-selling books, and he's made many best-selling videos about dog training. He's the inventor of puppy classes, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago. And you claim to be the first person to ever put treats inside a Kong?
That is true. Yes, I mean, I'm very friendly with the inventor of Kong. And he was actually, Joe Markham was a motorcycle racer, and he's fixing his motorcycle one day, and his dog runs off with the shock absorber, and he's really angry and chasing it around, and his mum said, you know, that would make a neat dog toy, so that's why we have the Kong. But I was in a seminar in Los Angeles, and someone had a chewing dog, and I said, well, get a Kong. So I've got a Kong. You know, one of these people, I've done it, doesn't work. I said, well, do you play Kong games? Yeah, done that, doesn't work. Have you hidden the Kong and have the dog? Yeah, done that. I said, then stuff food in it. And as I said that, I thought, oh, my word, what a clever idea. And it is, because now you see, you can give the dog the Kong before you leave for work, and the dog's trying to eat his breakfast, and in a minute he'll be lying down. Every bit of food that comes out rewards him for chewing the Kong, for lying down and not barking, and it's giving him a hobby to pass the time when he's home alone. So it actually kills four problems just like that.
A lot of people have trouble with dogs who have separation anxiety, or at least that's how people interpret it. When they're home alone, they have a lot of trouble. How do you approach that problem?
Well, I like the way you described it, as they interpret it. The first question is the dog anxious? And so that's the first thing I determine. Well, the first thing I do is say, stop feeding him from a bowl, feed him only from Kongs. And you're going to have to start when you're there, because if he is anxious, he won't touch it when you're gone. So we have to teach the dog eating when the owner's there, but first next to them, then in a different room, then maybe outside. And then at the same time, I'm testing to see if the dog actually is anxious. And I developed this little, it's called bark and activity counter, you put on the dog's collar, and it counts the number of barks, and it counts the number of paces the dog takes. And then you plug it into your computer with a USB port, and it graphs out when they did it. And when you look at the distribution of an anxious dog of barking and pacing is totally different from the distribution of a dog, say, that only misbehaves when left at home alone, because the owner has tried to control barking and chewing by punishing the dog when they're there. So, for example, before you leave, a dog who's an owner-absent misbehavior won't misbehave when you're getting ready for work, because he knows you don't have a sense of humor and you'll punish him. But an anxious dog is already getting anxious and pacing. And the instant you leave home, you get a peak from 0 to 100 in the owner-absent dog, because he thinks, right, owner's gone, woohoo. You know, this is not separation anxiety, this is separation fun. And the dog says, right, I'm going to have a quick chew, smoke some cigarettes, watch the telly, you know, turn on the Playboy channel, we here, chew this and what have you. Whereas the anxious dog, it builds as you're leaving, stays high all the time, and then drops off the instant you come home. So you get very different distributions. And because a lot of people, I think, are very, very cavalier about anxiety, and a lot of vets will just prescribe anti-anxiety medication without testing the dog's anxious. And a lot of owners, when I solve the behavior problem for them, so now their dog does not bark or pace or chew, we're left at home alone, they said, right, thank you. I said, yeah, but what about the anxiety? This dog's anxious. And they don't get it that now you've got to build the dog's confidence so he doesn't freak out when left at home alone, because anxiety is horrible. It's a horrible thing to have, a panic attack. I mean, any human listening will know that. Well, these poor dogs go through it every day.
How do you feel about kennels, kenneling dogs while you're gone?
I think it's a training process. If you think of a crate as a training tool, so that you're producing a dog that knows the house rules and has a full run of your house and garden. So, like, you know, my dog's trying to think, what time is it now? It's be 8:30 in California. I'm going to tell you exactly where they are. They're in the dining room waiting for breakfast. But they have full run of every room in the house and outdoors because I've taken the time to train them. Now, one of these dogs we adopted when she's 10 months old, and she was a terrible dog to house train. She spent a lot of time in the crate when we're there, but we're using the crate not as just a prison. We're using it as a predicting tool. So if you keep the dog in the crate when you're at home, she will settle down. And every hour on the hour, if you take her out, she's going to pee quickly. So now I can go up to the crate on the hour and say, Zuzu, you want to go pee? I'm starting to put it on cue. Then I run her to the toilet area, stand still, and I put her on leash too in the home. Stand still. When she pees, her, I gave about 8 liver treats in a row. Well done, Zuzu. Treat, 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 treat. She looks up at me, thinks, wow, you mean I can cash in my urine for treats? Well, damn, I'm going to save it when you're gone if I can cash it in when you come home. You know, so when we're using a crate as a training tool, in early puppyhood, very useful. And I encourage all the listeners to go to Dogstar Daily and download the 2 free books we've got there, which will show you how to use confinement tools properly. So now your dog is trained so he can enjoy the luxury of your house and be on the couch when you're gone and be in an air-conditioned house and be able to run around and look out the window or maybe go outside.
Do solitary dogs tend to have more behavior problems than dogs who have a buddy at home, another dog, or even a cat?
No, it's the same. Dogs have behavior problems that haven't been educated properly. And I should mention this because a lot of people think, oh, he's destroying the house when we're gone. We'll get another dog for company. Yeah, he needs another dog on his destruction team. And, I mean, I had a lovely pair of dogs on my TV program in England, and the owner was convinced this little black and white dog was bad dog chewing the house. So we put in little tiny remote control cameras. I mean, you know, they're just the size of a, you know, half an inch. And we filmed the dogs, and it was the other dog. The other dog would open the cabinet doors, pull out a bag of sugar, or go to the fridge, get out a slab of butter, put it on the floor, and the other dog would eat it. But the other dog was the troublemaker. And he would even, you know these waste baskets with the flip-flop top? He jumped up, put his paws on it, puts his head in, disappears inside, and you see this thing wobble and crash on the floor. Then all the trash is on the floor, and the black and white dog was just joining in, but he was not the instigator.
I'm talking with Dr. Ian Dunbar, veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and dog trainer. And we would be happy to take your calls. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm sure you spend a lot of your life answering questions. Before we get to the questions, though, I want to talk about some consulting work you did for the movie Up. And, of course, all of us who have seen the movie, especially if we're dog lovers, were very taken with the talking dogs in the movie. And here's just a clip.
We have your dog.
Whoa.
Wonder who he belongs to.
Sit, boy. Hey, look, he's trained. Shake. Uh-huh. Speak.
Hi there.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Brad!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
Just a moment from the movie Up, and you gave Doug and all of these other dogs
their
voices.
Funny because that's my favorite line. Hello, my name's Doug. I just met you, and I love you. I know so many dogs like that.
Exactly. It rang true for so many of us. So that must have been a lot of fun, but I felt like you really, really nailed these dog personalities and what they were thinking from my experience.
Well, so much was decided before I got there. They decided on the breed. So when I got there, I was shocked. And I thought, no, don't have a Doberman as alpha. You want like a Shih Tzu or a Pomeranian. Let's be real, you know. But, you know, the dogs have been picked. And I basically was there to talk, like, facial expressions and mannerisms and play and stuff like that. And it's very exciting. I mean, the Pixar campus is fantastic. And it was up on stage, and we had Dogstar Daily showing all the clips on Dogstar Daily. And you know, I did a demo, like, you know, it was like, what goes through a dog brain when he's going through the environment and the input? Oh, there's dog poop over there. Oh, there's a McDonald's wrap. Oh, there's a little boy on a skateboard. And squirrels. And this sort of thing. And it was wonderful. And I love watching the movie, although I was very worried at one point when they were being chased by all the dogs. And I was just saying, if you kill off these dogs, I'm going to scream. But it was cool. It was cool.
Right,
it was a magical movie.
The tennis balls solved the problem,
yes.
Which is a wonderful solution. I also want to ask about something that I think I read about you in the newspaper years and years and years ago. Did I read an article about you training dogs from animal shelters to be service dogs of some kind?
No,
okay.
I've consulted and assisted in many of those programs and prison programs too. I mean, they're just things I love it when people go to a shelter to get a dog to train to give a job. And I especially love it when it's a prison program and they go from the shelter into the prison, they get to stay with the prisoners, and the effect, the change it has is unbelievable, unbelievable. It gives the prisoners self-esteem, it gives them a reason to be, it gives them an occupation.
And how do you assess a dog from a shelter? How do you know if this is a dog that you could work with?
Well, I mean, well, any dog you can work with. I mean, the big question with shelter dogs is he dangerous? So that's the one thing that really needs to be assessed. Not does he react, not is he scared, not does he, you know, snap or what have you, but does he cause damage? And, you know, we just get in there, and I think, you know, shelters, they really do need more behavior and training there. And so my wife and I designed a behavior and training program for shelters called Open Paw. I have to spell it. I can't say it in American. It's Open, P-A-W, Paw, doggy paw. so that when the dog is there, it's kind of like then the shelter is a cross between a university and a country club. You can't have a dog in a shelter without taking him to pee four times a day, or else he'll soil his shelter cage and now he's less adoptable. So we have these like vibrant programs that will bring in, say, 500 volunteers, and they train the dogs up. But that's not the big part of the program. The actual part of the program is it's the training of the dogs, which is the teacher, which trains the volunteers how to train dogs. So they now go home to their dog and they know how to train it, and they can help their neighbors and so on. And I think a shelter should be much more of an educational center with hands-on training. Come on in and help us train our dogs so we can get them adopted. And so then people know how to train dogs.
Let's get to some questions. This is an email from Lori. She says, I have a wonderful retired from racing greyhound. Does she remember her life while racing? I'm trying to make up for the life she had on the track, but I often wonder how much her early life on the track shaped her personality.
I mean, these are questions we don't know. I always tell people that there's a big difference between behavior and then the dog's thoughts, needs, emotions. Behavior is observable. It is quantifiable. You can't argue about it. You know, woof, woof, woof. The dog barked three times. Why did the dog bark? Is she upset? Is she needy? Is she having memories? And so we don't know. I mean, to give an educated guess, and mine is as good as anyone else's, I would say, of course, it remembers its time on the track. I mean, a dog's not an idiot. And a large part of its life was, you know, in a cage and then chasing electric hare. Of course, the memories are there. And one old dog we adopted, he was going to be euthanized because he bit someone at the shelter. And so I went to look at him. He bit me four times, but it didn't hurt. So he's just scared. He's not dangerous. So his name was Claude. And to the day he died, when he was 14, he would have these dreams. And if you woke him up in the dream, I think he was having a flashback. He would go, woo, right in my face. And I'd go, Claude, it's me. And then he'd go, oh, and lick my face. And I think he was having flashbacks in the dreams, and I don't know what happened before we got him, but from behavioral forensics, I call it, you know, CSI dog, you look at what a dog does, and I knew it was something to do with men. I knew it was a man's dog, but he also was scared of men, and it had to do with a truck, was really scared of trucks. So actually our UPS man helped us get him over that. He said, can I carry a bag of treats around, and then we'll meet the dog every day? And it took about 3 weeks. And then Claude just hopped in his truck one day and says, right, I'm ready to go with you. So we don't know for certain what a dog's thinking or feeling any more than you know what your spouse is thinking or feeling or your children. We know what they do. And so that's where I focus my energies. And I ask people, what's your dog doing? You happy with that? No. Then how do you want your dog to act? Because that's where I can help you. When we get to the thinky-feely bit, we don't know for certain. But I would imagine, yeah, dogs have pretty similar thoughts and emotions to us.
Let's go to the phones. Taylor is on the line. Hello, Taylor.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to thank you for having Dr. Dunbar on the show. I work with canine behavior and volunteer at a shelter, and I had heard his name but wasn't familiar with his work, so I'll definitely be checking out the website, and the Open Paw program sounds very interesting. I'm trying to figure out how to make strides in shelters and help the dogs to be more adoptable and less likely to return for behavior issues. So thank you for being on the program. And my question is, in dealing with aggression issues between dogs in multiple dog households, in rehabilitating for that aggression, how would you deal with that?
Well, in the multiple dog household, we have the luxury that one person is responsible for all the dogs, which is very different than if you have a dog who's dog aggressive, and then you take him out and inflict him on other unsuspecting dogs and dog owners. Now, whenever the specter of aggression sort of raises its ugly head, whether it's dog or dog human or dog being aggressive to other animals, the first thing you've got to be really serious about and absolutely utterly objective is this dangerous, yes or no? So with dog aggression, I want to come up with what I call the fight-bite ratio for every dog. So I want to know how many full contact fights has this dog had, and I list them. And then I want to count. And ironically, the larger the number, usually the better the prognosis, because the assumption is, well, they can't be that serious. But then I go through each fight and I want to know, did this dog go to the vet clinic, the victim? And usually you find with dog fighting, they've had a whole bunch of fights. Well, usually they're pretty young dogs, usually 6 months to 3 years old. They're often male. They have a whole bunch of fights. And the owner tells me, oh, God, they fight all the time and they're trying to, you know, kill the other dog. Yet when we analyze it, I find out, well, this dog's had 11 fights and he's never put another dog in the vet clinic. So if he really is trying to kill the other dog, he's just not very good at it. So now we know this dog is not dangerous. And so that really now expands our treatment options, and we just get in there and we can pretty much do what we like because it's not dangerous. Lots of classical conditioning, which means like you work with a subject dog, the other dog leaves the room, and then he comes in, he leaves, he comes in, he leaves. He's on leash with another person. You ignore the subject dog when the dog's gone, and when he comes in, you praise him. So the dog learns, wow, this is interesting. You know, mum's really interested, or dad's really happy when the other dog's here, and he gets really sad when the other dog's gone. And this creates a nice feeling in the dog, so he's less likely to fight.
And it sounds like one of those problems that you would need a lot of information to work through.
I would need 2 days to talk about this, yeah.
Right.
Especially if the dog were dangerous.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Ian Dunbar. We'll continue our conversation and take your calls at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Dr. Ian Dunbar. He is a world-renowned veterinarian, animal behaviorist, and dog trainer. You can find out more about his work at dogstardaily.com. And he is answering your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this is a question from Kristen, and I know this is something that you've given a lot of thought to. She says, I would love to hear some commentary about training a dog with children in the home. We have a 7-year-old boy, a 5-year-old girl, and a 7-month-old. How do we work together to train our puppy?
Well, firstly, the 7-month-old can't do much, but I would certainly bring it into the training. That what happens when we have babies, the dog gets squeezed out. And so I think it's very important to do some baby activities with the dog. And so what I used to do was we had 3 activities. One was feeding. So if the dog is feeding, so breastfeeding with my wife, or I use a bottle, the dog's a part of this. I say, Omaha, come over here, settle down. It's chow time. I'm holding Jamie. I'm feeding him. And I'm hand-feeding Omaha freeze-dried liver treats. Diaper changing. I say, hey, Omaha, we need to change the diapers. He comes in. He used to love sniffing it.
Sure. I was going to say, you don't need to encourage dogs.
Then I'd have him sit. I'd give him a liver treat, a little jar of treats on the diaper changing table. Then I'd change the diapers. I'd fold them up so he can't get any yucky bits, but let them sniff them old ones. He loved it. Then throw them away. Then clean Jamie and rechange them. Then let the dog sniff the new job. And then give him another treat. And I actually inadvertently trained Omaha to alert when Jamie was about to mess his diapers. One night I was lying down, Omaha goes to the door. And I said, what's wrong, Omaha? And I go in, whoa, Jamie's breaking wind. And I got him before he messed them. So I got him over to the toilet when he was very, very young. And I had actually, you know, trained, I think, the world's first dirty diaper detection dog.
Nice,
you know,
nice.
The other 2 kids, we have them train. And that's the beauty of the training methods that I advocate, lure reward training. Children need lots of help. Stand behind them. They call the dog, they tell it to sit, they lure it to sit with their hand, they hand feed it. And when you do this training process, come here, sit, treat, come here, sit, treat, come here, sit, treat, the ultimate thing is the dog says, I love these kids. It's lovely. Every time I approach them and sit, they pet me and give me a treat. And that's what we call classical conditioning. And I make sure that the adults in the family and who come to visit the house only give kibble. But for the kids, I put some nice treats in their bag, just little ones. I don't want junk food, so we, you know, ruin the dog's pancreas. But the dog soon learns, I love people, I love visitors, I especially like children. And so now the dog has no notion to snap or bite.
Let's go back to the phone. Cindy is on the line from Anamosa. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
First of all, great program. I have 2 Shar Pei's that are rescue dogs, and the one that is 2.5 licks one spot on our kitchen floor probably twice a day. lays there and licks. We thought it was the floor. We had ceramic tile. We've since gotten a new floor. It is now a stone floor, and he licks the same spot. Is he bored? Is, you know, he comes when you call him. He gets petted and gets a lot of love and loves that. But we don't know about his floor licking.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, we're not going to know why he's doing it. I mean, I would say this started for a reason. You dropped something on the floor and he licked it. He likes lying in that spot, and now that has become a habit. It's what he does. People and dogs are very habitual with their behavior. For example, I just gave a two-day workshop, and on the second day, I said, you see where you're all sitting? In the same chairs where you sat yesterday. So we're very habitual about where we like to lie down. We have favorite chairs. Like in the studio now, I chose my chair, and then they said, oh, could you sit in the other chair?
I'm very habitual.
No, I don't want to. I want to be here, you know. And so the behavior is benign. It's not doing any harm. So the question is, does it disturb you? If it disturbs you, then let's train it out. If not, let the dog occasionally lick the floor. So the way I would train it out is, if the dog licks the floor, I would say, get your chew toy, you know, which is a Kong or an Antler. They're really good chew toys, very expensive, but they're very good. They last forever and dogs love them. And once you've changed the licking habit over to now an appropriate toy, like a deer antler or a Kong stuffed with food, and so we're happy. And if you're not happy with the dog lying in the middle of the kitchen, which I hate, I don't allow my dogs have to lie outside of the kitchen when I'm cooking because I trip over the French bulldog. He just has the ability to always lie down where I want to walk, between the oven and the fridge, and it's actually very dangerous. So I say, lie down, and I put a dog bed there for them to lie down so they stick to the place I want them. So I would do things like this if it's disturbing you, but it ain't really a big problem.
All right, Esther's on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Esther.
Hi. I'm calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I have a Labradoodle who is just turned 3 like 2 days ago, and I love him to death, but my question is, I think he is not very cuddly and too independent for me. I mean, he's a great dog. He's not hyper at all. He's just too laid back. So my question is, like, if let's say, you know, we cuddle him and he'll be, like, getting up and leave and go to another room and go, like, I'm done cuddling. Give me some personal space. And he will just leave us to go to another room. So I would like him to be more of a lab dog or cuddly.
Then, you know, I would train him to be. I mean, he sounds like my first dog. I mean, the dogs I have at the moment, there's no space on the couch. They all lie on top of me. But my first dog was very, very independent, and he'd always lie down on cold floors, and didn't like being in the living room, didn't like being on the couch. And one day I thought, you know, there's no bonding happening here. So I actually trained him, and I'd say, come here. And I put down a bit of linoleum over the carpet so it was cool because he's a big woolly Malamute. And I would say, oh, my God, lie down. And I would hand feed him his meal bit by bit. After about the fourth day, I noticed he had sat up and he put his chin on my lap and he looked at me and I stroked him. And it was a magical moment because it was really the beginning of togetherness. And then we would go on camping trips, just him and me and the dog in the tent, and we just totally bonded. And he turned into a very, very affectionate dog that would lie close. But I think it was the heat problem, why he didn't want to, you know, be on carpets or furniture or to lie on top of me. So, you know, I did. I actually bought leather furniture for him, and then he was more happier on the couch. And I would, you know, not like crush him when I'm petting him. So, yeah, weigh out your dog's kibble in the morning. Hand feed it if the dog's next to you when you're petting it. You'll have a different dog in 1 week.
All right. Let's go to Kelly on the line in Davenport. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. I have a Bedlington Terrier, and she was very easy to potty train. She'd ring a bell, you know, 3 days after we got her to go outside. But in the middle of the night, even though she's peed before we've, you know, taken her to bed, sometimes she'll go pee in the same little spot against the wall. And I don't know how to break her of that habit.
Well, first of all, affectionate memories of Bedlingtons. I went to Bedlington and went to the Bedlington pub and met Bedlington breeders there. So, you know, you've got a lovely little dog there. First, you've got to acknowledge that you think you've house-trained your dog, but you haven't. She is still occasionally peeing inside, so she's not quite fully house-trained. So at night time, I would either put her in a crate beside the bed, have a lie on a dog bed beside your bed, on leash and tied, you know, to an eye hook in the wall so she can't move, so she can't get to this spot. But more importantly, so if she does wake up, she's closer to you, so you can get up in the middle of the night and take a go pee. However, we want her to go through the night, so I would say let's split people in the family into two shifts. We want night shift, morning shift. And we had to do this with the latest dog we adopted. I do night shift, and I empty that dog out at 2:30 a.m. I go to bed then. My wife gets up at 6 and empties the dog out at 6. And then we stretch the time. I would empty the dog later and later. I mean, earlier and earlier in the evening, she would empty it later and later until now the dog can last, a good 10 hours at night if we oversleep. That's a gradual process. Most important aspect of it is when your dog urinates in the right place, you say, good girl, you praise it like it's done the most wonderful and glorious thing, and you give one treat, two treats, three treats, four treats, five treats, and the dog thinks, wow, that's fantastic. I don't get this when I pee on the wall in the middle of the night. So that's the most important thing always in training, to think, what do you want the dog to do? Set it up so it does it, and then reward the dog for getting it right. And then the dog will be more likely to get it right in the future. And then you won't have problems because there's only so much urine to go around, right?
So it may take a little while, but the dividends will pay off.
I don't think too long. I think, you know, 1, 2, or 3 weeks, we should solve the problem, yes.
All right. Next, let's go to Rick on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Morning.
Hi.
We have a black lab, half black lab, and it has some pit and box on it. Excuse me. And we got it from the shelter when I was 4 years old. And I trained it out in the park where there's ski trails and everything else. And she loves being off leash. And 90% of the time, she responds to me very well. But in consideration to other people walking their dogs, especially smaller dogs, I will leash her up, and a lot of times that's the consideration of the other people. As soon as she's on leash, if the smaller dog even looks at her wrong, she'll start to get what appears to be aggressive. And I was wondering if you have any advice on how to deal with, I guess, other people and their dogs.
Well, I do, but more importantly, it's you and your dog. I mean, you need to train your dog, and I say this is what I do in my workshops and spend 2 days doing it with people. At first, we need to teach the dog a few things and make sure she's reliable. Sit and look at you. So here's what I do when I meet another dog, even though my dogs are really friendly with dogs. I point the dog out, say, hey, look, there's another dog. Come here. I take 2 steps backwards, have the dog sit, and I pull out a tug toy. So now my dog is sitting and looking at me, so he's not eyeballing the other dog. And also the dogs forming the association. It's like, well, you know, I don't really like other little dogs, but whenever I see a little dog, my dad gets so happy and he laughs and he walks backwards and has me sit and he pulls out the tug toy and then we play a little game of tug and he praises me and we get some treats. So this is the classical conditioning component of it. So the dog forms the associations that you're happy when you see other dogs, but also the operant or the training part of it is you're controlling your dog. And the key words there are sit, watch, and shush. And then everyone is looking at you and saying, well, his dog's under control. And it's probably the little dog that's being a pain and doing things that he couldn't do. For example, you know, if you're a lower ranking dog and they know it from a distance, 50 yards away, one glance, they know who's higher ranking. If the under ranking dog makes eye contact, that's terrible. That's the equivalent of, say, a 16-year-old youth going in a Harley Davidson bar and shouting out, Harleys suck. You know, it's really inflammatory. And so a lot of it could be provoked by the little dogs, but you always have to make sure that your dog is blameless. He's sitting, looking at you, and you are laughing and praising him.
We have two different questions on the line right now about dogs that were easy to train, off-leash, but wander off or run off because because they do. So what is your advice for teaching a dog to stay close to you off a leash?
We do a lot of, I mean, to me, it's the major part of training is just producing centripetal attraction. So the opposite of centrifugal, instead of the dog zooming off into space and you find him in Minnesota or Missouri, the dog wants to stay close to you. So we start the exercises in very safe areas in the home. We have following courses, following races. hiding from the dog is very, very useful, especially when your dog's off leash, and making weird noise from hiding, like, where are you? And so the dog gets, well, I've lost my owner, lost my owner. And with a puppy, you do that once, you'll never forget. If it was a puppy less than 16 weeks old and you hide from him, you've almost trained him for life. So we do loads and loads of exercises of will the dog follow you? And we just did it in Minnesota with probably the two craziest dogs at the workshop. And I just said, meet the beast. You got to do this. So let him off leash. And the black lab just went spazzo. The schnauzer, equally so. And I said, now get them to follow you around the room. And you find little tricks like have a toy in your hand. Have a tug toy. So a great way to train a dog is teach him fetch or teach him tug. And you think about it. So now he's out running. You just throw a tennis ball at him, and the silly dog picks it up and runs back to you because he knows we can't play the game unless he brings it back to you. Same with tug. He has to come back to you. Go to a clicker class, and you'll get a free recall because every time you click, you're going to feed the dog a treat, so he runs back to you and get the treat. And so integrate the training into the walk. Come here, go play. Come here, go play. Don't just let the dog off leash and run willy-nilly. You're creating the biggest distraction in training. Sit, go play, sit, go play, sit, go play. So now go play is the reward for sitting.
We are out of time for questions, which I'm sure is disappointing a lot of people. But before I let you go, you've been doing this for so many years, but you have such enthusiasm. And when you answer these questions, you seem to be very interested in every dog's story and just seem to enjoy what you're doing so much. How do you keep this fresh?
I love it. It's the thing I like about dog behavior, that I was going to be a veterinarian, and I worked out really quickly 80% of that job is going to be very repetitious, you know, spaying a dog or a different dog over and over, anal glands. With behavior, every dog is different, and no matter what I know, I occasionally meet the dog where I think I have no idea what's going on here, and it stretches my brain. But above all, I love watching puppies. And I love seeing the smile on people's faces when we just solved the problem. And now, you know, they have a good buddy, because I think living with a dog is the best thing in the world. It's your own little companion to hug. It's your own little psychologist. And I just love it. What can I say? I have the best job in the world, not you.
You've been studying dog behavior for many years, but you also have been probably watching human behavior as well. In just 15 seconds, why do you think we have such a bond with dogs?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. It's in a nutshell, I would say, because we have a lot of difficulty, I think, expressing our feelings and communicating what we want with people, that it's much easier to do it with a dog.
Dr. Ian Dunbar, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ian Dunbar, world-renowned dog trainer, veterinarian, animal behaviorist. His website is dogstardaily.com. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get an inside look at what life was like for rural women in Iowa during the Great Depression. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.